I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney.
The real outperformance has been the U.S. corporate high yield.
Are the companies lean enough? Have they trimmed all the fat?
The semiconductor business is a really cyclical business.
Breaking market headlines and corporate news from across the globe.
Do investors like the M&A that we've seen?
These are two big-time blue-chip companies.
The window between the peak and cut changing super fast.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney. On Bloomberg Radio.
On today's Bloomberg Intelligence Show, we dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide you in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, we'll look at what earnings from the world's largest alternative asset manager tell us about the health of financial markets.
Plus, we're going to discuss how energy companies are working to satisfy high demand for power.
But first, we dive into the EV space and Tesla. This week, Tesla announced it is slashing headcount by more than 10%. CEO Elon Musk cited duplication of roles and the need to reduce costs.
We also heard that Senior Vice President Drew Baglino and Rohan Patel, Vice President of Public Policy and Business Development, have also departed. So for more on this, we were joined by Steve Mann, Bloomberg Intelligence Global Autos and Industrials Research Analyst.
We first asked Steve for his take on this week's news.
It's actually worse than I thought. I thought, the first quarter sales drop was, hopefully close to the end, but there's seems to be the light at the end of the tunnel is not really here yet. And it looks like their plants are running just pretty much well below capacity at the moment. And there's still a lot of cost headwinds facing them. They're trying to balance a lot of things in terms of deliveries, production. They're raising prices. I don't know how long that's going to last. So execution is key for the company in the next 6 to 9 months.
Steve, where are we now, or where is the market when you talk to investors in terms of getting a sense of where EV demand is in the U.S. and then maybe globally?
Well, EV demand is waning. I think the interest rate is not helping. They're looking to, the Fed's probably not going to cut rates anytime soon in the next couple of months, next quarter or so. So that's going to continue to weigh on big purchases like automobiles. We're seeing that across the board in the U.S. as well as in China. China's a little bit worse for Tesla because there's so much new competition there. Sales is slowing for GM. Sales is slowing for Ford. Ford just had to cut production of their Lightning recently announced about a couple of weeks ago. So I think this year will be tough for the industry. We probably won't see any improvement until as far as I'm concerned, 2026.
Steve, why 2026? Why is it going to take that long?
Yeah, I think what the EV market is facing today is that we had early adopters, especially on the high end. They're pretty much tapped out. They can buy only so many. The market is relatively smaller than the mass market. I'm looking at 2026 because if you look at the Inflation Reduction Act, it's bringing in onshoring a lot of the EV battery production in the U.S. Hopefully, it will cut costs. And at the same time, in 2026, we're looking at more affordable EVs coming into the market. That's going to expand the addressable market for EVs. And that's why we're thinking, 2026 will probably be a better time for the EV market than it is today.
So, how about profitability in that scenario, Steve? It's tough to make an argument that, these EVs can be profitably manufactured at a higher price point. How are they going to adjust their cost structure to be profitable at maybe a lower price point? I don't know, $30,000 or something like that.
That's a good question. I think if you look at the EV startups in the U.S., the only one that's really still profitable is Tesla. You saw Fisker being delisted. There's risk of them filing bankruptcy. Both Lucid and Rivian will need billions of dollars just to get them through the next couple of years. We're not sure if they're going to get that money given the slowdown in the EV market. But on the bright side, I think Tesla is still generating cash. You know, they're making some of the cuts today, I think, really to maintain cash generation so they can continue to invest for the long term. Mm-hmm. You know, for them, I think what's really important for them is the AI, the FSD, the full self-driving system that they're trying to build out. That's going to be the future of the automotive industry. It's really those software-based subscriptions that's going to drive revenue, not so much of the automaking. So if they're trying to get there, trying to maintain cash, maintain some level of profitability to make those investments to get them there.
Let's go to the SVP departing. So Drew Baglino, leaving the company, as I mentioned, senior vice president. Who is he? Do we care? Like how big a deal he was in Tesla? What did he do? Walk us through it.
He looks like to be the right-hand person for Elon Musk. So it's a big loss for the company, no doubt about it. But you know, he's a powertrain engineer for the most part, energy engineer. So he's really involved in the battery. If you saw him on Battery Day, I think, you know, if you look at Tesla and what Elon Musk have been saying about Tesla's future, which is on AI, which is on full self-driving, is it a big loss? I mean, you can argue that, hey, you know, Tesla is moving on to the next phase. It's not about building the motor. It's not about building the batteries. They've gone through that process over the past 15, 18 years. You know, I think, you know, looking forward, they probably need somebody, more people around AI, you know, development algorithms for the future of the car.
Our thanks to Steve Mann, Bloomberg Intelligence, Global Autos and Industrials Research Analyst.
We move next to the world's largest alternative asset manager, Blackstone. Blackstone reported higher quarterly earnings than expected, and the firm also collected more fees from big retail funds and credit strategies during the first quarter, and all of this helped compensate for a slower pace of deal exits.
For more, we were joined by Paul Goldberg, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Equity Analyst. We first asked him for his take on the latest quarterly results.
The numbers, I would break them up in three buckets. One, the fee growth, which was fairly decent, but not the double-digit breakneck growth that we've seen in years prior to the painful 2023 and late 2022. The second one is key themes, and those things are getting better. So you do get a private credit business that was working pretty well. You have wealth management business that you mentioned that's working pretty well. They reached $240 billion in assets in the wealth management with their goal of 250, so they're pretty much at their goal. And lastly, the painful part is the deal activity in terms of deployments and particularly realizations that produce performance fees. And that sort of becomes still a pain point for Blackstone, and that's a drag on their earnings.
Paul, what have they been saying about that? Because again, you're right, we haven't seen a lot of M&A activity. We haven't seen a lot of IPO activity, the types of exit events that would allow them to realize some returns on their investments. What are they saying about the next 6 to 12 months?
Well, I would actually look a little bit beyond that, because on the call they were really talking about 2024, and before they were really hopeful for the second half of 24 to get better. But then Jonathan Gray was actually on Bloomberg TV. He kind of mentioned the more return of activity is probably going to be more of a late 24 and into 25 matter. So I would look a little bit beyond the next 6 months, maybe the next 9 to 12.
If they have a hard time exiting investments, how do they then raise more money for new funds? Really, how does that work?
Well, I think it's the issue, not just the, we kind of very focused on the private equity when we talk about that, but the third of their business is private equity, a third of their business is real estate, and there are some opportunities, and performance in real estate gotten a little bit better, so the fundraising came back to some extent, the BREIT, BCRED, the retail funds, the outflows kind of stopped there, so perpetual vehicles are doing pretty well for them. And the last category, the credit category, that's just been a very strong grower, and that's reached out about a third of their assets at this point.
Paul, yeah, you mentioned real estate, and of course, historically, Blackstone's been a big, big player in the real estate business. What is their call on office? A, do they have a lot of exposure there? And B, how concerned are they about it?
There was nothing discussed in terms of office really on the call. They have about 1 or 2% of total assets in office space,
okay.
Maybe even less than that. So it's a fairly small amount. They are super focused on the multifamily. During the quarter, they made a $10 billion deal for AIR Communities. They take private deals, so they're still very focused on that. They've been up for over the last 10, 15 years. They also gave some specific numbers around the logistics and infrastructure. So there's about $50 billion of investments in that already. Mm-hmm. We're talking about that's 5% of the total assets, just in that.
Private credit, Paul, what's Blackstone say about this business? It's obviously just a booming business. Assets under management are just skyrocketing. There's some calls for maybe some greater transparency, maybe even some regulation of the private credit business. What's the Blackstone take on that part of the business?
It's been very strong. As I mentioned, it's reached about a third of their assets, $300+ billion. They do have a lot of different vehicles there. They do a lot of direct lending, but they also have the largest business development company, which is geared towards retail, BCRED. That's a huge vehicle for them. There was a lot of growth. First quarter, there were actually some questions because you had a syndicated loan market, with lending from the banks come back to some extent, reclaiming some of the mojo that the private credit got last year. But it's a long-term game, so over time, there's still a lot of opportunity for private credit. We ran some numbers. We think if you think of investment grade and potential for replacement, especially for those insurance companies, it could be a $40 trillion addressable market.
Oh,
and private credit is, we're talking about 1.6, 1.7 trillion right now. So there's a lot of opportunity still to take the incremental 1 or 2 or 3% of that market still.
Before we let you go, so Blackstone set the tone. What do you think the other big asset managers are going to come out with?
It's a little bit difficult because the earnings for them kind of idiosyncratic to some extent because these are private investments. They're large and sometimes they move in different directions. There's about 2 weeks until the next one reports. So there's most of them reports over the end of April and early May. I think from what we've seen from Blackstone, the private credit is going to hold fairly well, which is a positive for companies like Apollo and Ares.
Mm-hmm.
Private equity realizations exits are still a little bit more difficult, so it might give some pain to the guys like Carlyle. KKR, they actually pre-announced their realizations a few weeks before the end of the quarter, so we know the numbers were pretty light. So that's not going to be a surprise, but on the other hand, rates are staying higher for longer. They bought out the rest of the business from Global Atlantic, so the insurance business is going to do well and provide them some earnings in that area.
Our thanks to Paul Goldberg, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Equity Analyst.
Coming up, we're going to discuss how energy companies are working to satisfy high demand for power.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
This week, Bloomberg Intelligence Radio visited Bloomberg NEF's annual Energy and Climate Summit in New York. The summit brings together corporate executives, government officials, and industry leaders.
This year, speakers at the event covered topics ranging from clean power, trade, federal U.S. policy, hydrogen, and climate technology. We begin with power, and we were joined by David Crane, Undersecretary for Infrastructure at the U.S. Department of Energy.
David says the demand growth for power in the U.S. is going to be more than we thought. So for the last 10 years, power demand was up just 50 basis points a year, and now we're looking at 5 to 6% a year. And we first asked David what all of this means.
Well, 5 to 6% in our world is huge. I mean, that's like tiger economies from the 1990s. And because of the long lead time of most things in the electricity sector, those 5 to 6% per year pile up if you're not getting after it. So what it means is, and what's very important in all this as we look at these transitioning to the clean energy economy, all these new technologies, is you always have to ask the time question. What do you need in what time frame, and what are the solutions that fit, that land within that time frame?
You know, a couple of summers ago, my summer read was The Grid, fraying wires between Americans and our energy future.
You read that?
I read that on the beach, and people were laughing at me,
so
like, what a geek.
Paul.
So I feel like I know what I'm talking about here. And what I know is we need constant investment in our energy grid. And if Alex is right, that energy demand is going to keep increasing, that's even more so. What are some of the key issues that you need to tackle or trying to tackle, at least in the short term here?
Well, first of all, I need to tackle what your summer reading is
yes.
on the beach, because, Paul, I think you got to get a life.
If yeah,
that's
exactly.
What if that's
exactly.
what you're... I think, well, I mean, one big one, the missing link, and I mentioned this on stage as well, is permitting reform.
Okay.
I mean, we're very supportive of permitting reform. It takes a lot of different permutations. I'm personally not a policy person. I'm the implementation person, but... we just need to do things faster, because just the scale of infrastructure that exists under this new legislation, just in my area, by the end of this year, we will have invested in over 100 infrastructure projects that are over $100 million each. And so we're straining the system in many different ways, but permitting should not be the bottleneck.
So to break that down a little bit, when we say permitting, what are we talking about? And I say that in terms of, like, are we going to have to move power lines underground, for example? Do we need more transmission lines if we're going to set up that hydrogen hub or a new nuclear facility and we need to get that to the grid? Does it mean we need to just kind of start over and, like, do a new grid? Like, there's a lot of ways that infrastructure can be used. What does it actually mean for you?
Well, of the two that you mentioned specifically.
Any of them. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I would leave aside undergrounding wires, because that's more of a climate mitigation thing. It's where you need to do it, it's very important. But mm-hmm. in terms of solving the demand issue, the transmission thing breaks into sort of two parts, and the answer is yes and yes. We need both. One is we need more transmission lines to move the energy around the country, or at least around regions. But then we also need this thing, which is grid innovation, which is a series of technologies which are not in the popular mindset, things like reconductoring, where you basically take an existing rights of way in the towers and you take down the ceramic circular things and, mm-hmm. and in some cases the wires, and you what we call reconductoring. And you can get 2 to 3 times the amount of power over the same line.
Oh,
and you don't need a right of way. It's cheaper, and that's good for ratepayers. And we just, in fact, published a report about this at the DOE called the Grid Innovation Liftoff Report. And so there's that, and there's a host of other things. But basically, we need all of the above right now.
And is this a federal-funded issue, or is this a federal and state issue? How local does it get? Because I think of Texas with its own grid, and I'm wondering how... Should they be integrated, for example, into the national grid? I mean, I don't.
They're not going to want that.
Yeah, I don't know exactly.
Yeah, Paul, that's what I'm not touching. I mean, there's a reason that Texas is a sovereign unto itself.
Yes, exactly.
when it comes to their electric system. But we have a lot of financing tools in the tool chest, but most of them are set up as sort of matching funds. We put up to 50% against 50% coming from basically anywhere else that's not federal government.
Okay.
So we say 50%+ from non-federal sources. And if it's states, if it's the private sector, that's all good with us.
And that's what you need to see in order to commit the money after that.
Yes, yeah.
So how does this all square? So the stuff you're talking about, like reconstituting the grid like that, like that's not sexy cool stuff, like clean tech and hydrogen, right?
Yeah.
How much of your job is on the energy that we're going to need in 50 years? And how much of that is how do we get more transmission mechanisms? How do we get that plug that we can't get so we can change the grid?
You know, Alex, I was getting a little hung up on what's actually sexy in the world of electricity, but I'm glad that you can distinguish between hydrogen on one and transmission. But what I'd say is, first of all, nothing that if I thought that what I was doing was just affecting things in 2050, like you know, at my age, I wouldn't be doing it. But we're aiming for the Biden administration goal of zero carbon electric sector by 2035. And so the premise of your question is correct. Because of this new awareness of demand issues, I would say that what I've been focused on my 2 years at the DOE is what does the system look like sort of between 2028 to 2035. First of a kind, fast following commercial. But because of this new concern, I think we're going to be even looking at more 3 to 5 year solutions. And that's where things like the grid innovation is important, because that's a 3 to 5 year solution.
Our thanks to David Crane, Undersecretary for Infrastructure at the U.S. Department of Energy.
And staying on power, at Bloomberg's NEF Annual Energy and Climate Summit, we were also joined by Pedro Pizarro, President and CEO of Edison International.
Pedro discussed the transition to clean energy and how to satisfy the demand for power that we're seeing right now. With regards to demand, we first asked Pedro just how high it is and who's calling.
I can tell you from a Southern California Edison perspective, our utility, we had had flat growth for the last 15 years. We're now seeing something like 2% load growth. And in our state, a lot of it is transportation electrification. I'm also chair of the Edison Electric Institute, which represents the investor-owned utilities across the country, about 70% of the load. 2 years ago, EEI members were forecasting something like a 2% load growth over the next years ahead. The most updated numbers are 4.7%.
Wow.
And I have colleagues in some states that are seeing 5, 6, 7%. So who's calling? It is electrification in places like California, more broadly across the country, but I think we're more leading edge there. It is data center growth. We've read a lot about that. And then it's also the repatriation of manufacturing. You know, the bipartisan infrastructure law is working, and it's bringing back a lot of manufacturing into the country, and that's another source.
Oh, interesting.
So can you, being your company and your industry, can you handle that increase in load?
Yes. There will be some. Yes, and there will be some bumps in the road, right? I was sharing with Alex earlier that it's not the first time in our history of the industry we've seen this, right? Rural electrification, air conditioning load. So we've lived through these periods. It's been the last 15 years or so that it's been fairly flat. So how do we handle it? In the near term, right, you see a lot of focus of utilities working in their various regions, power companies, working with regional transmission organizations, and working with customers too, make sure we're using every tool available. Demand side management is important. Energy efficiency is important. But so is making sure that we can maintain and in some cases expand existing resources. And ultimately, we need to add new resources to the system.
How do you pay for that? Because as yields have moved higher, stock moves lower, and then it's more expensive to borrow. How do you do it?
Well, you know, it is an investment in infrastructure that's needed. And this is an industry that's been investing for a long time. Our members at EEI have invested over $1 trillion over the last decade on infrastructure, $168 billion last year alone. Right?
So that's eventually the ratepayer, right?
It is eventually the ratepayer, right? And so we have a responsibility to make sure that that investment is economic, is being done thoughtfully, is being done efficiently. But importantly, this investment has multiple uses, right? There is the near-term need to keep up with demand, but there's also the longer-term need for investing towards decarbonization, right? And the industry's been going as clean as we can, as fast as we can, but while maintaining reliability and affordability. And so those investments are the same investments that are needed to build out the transmission grid, to add renewable resources, to add storage, and that helps with climate change mitigation. There's also investment that we're needing to put in to deal with climate change adaptation, right? The effects of extreme weather, the effects we've seen initially in California and now across
everywhere.
The country in wildfire, right? So my own company has been investing billions of dollars to redesign the system to harden it against wildfires. Other colleagues are having to do that now. So all of these investments accrue to the customer benefit, whether it's to keep the system safer, keep communities safer, and also to support the demand growth that we're seeing.
Alex and I spoke to David Crane, Undersecretary for Infrastructure at the U.S. Department of Energy, and he said one of his major goals over the next several years is to make permitting easier, so presumably to allow companies like yours to make these investments and maybe in a quicker manner. Are you seeing that, or what do you need to see?
Absolutely need it.
Okay.
And so if you gave me a magic wand and gave me one wish for the industry, it would be that.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
All right. And we have other challenges, supply chain, labor availability, but it's really siting and permitting that needs the most help. Just to frame it for you a little bit, Paul, the analysis that we've done as Edison for California and what will it take to decarbonize the whole California economy by 2045, it's a state's net zero goal, still feasible, right? But it will require significant investment for renewables, for storage, for the grid, $370 billion of investment statewide through 2045. That analysis, by the way, from an affordability perspective, back to your comment earlier, Alex, we do see that that will put pressure on electric rates and bills, but because it's a transition, right? A lot of that electrification will be removing uses in the economy that today are using combustion processes with fossil fuels. These are more efficient technologies, right? The electric car is more efficient than an internal combustion engine car. We see the total energy bill for our average customer, electric plus gas plus gasoline, going down by 40% in real terms between now and 2045. So that goes to these investments having a co-benefit of affordability. As we look at how we, you know, proceed with, with this kind of investment, you know, we have to keep in mind that it has those multiple benefits.
So that all of it has to work at the same time for that to be that 40% decline.
Absolutely. And we need to be able to get the steel in the ground through siting and permitting.
Right. Yep.
And so part of our analysis showed that the rate at which we add transmission will need to be four times the annual rate that it's been historically. The rate at which we add distribution, the lower voltage wires, will need to be 10 times the rate. So when David Crane talked about siting and permitting, absolutely needed. And it's help that we need at both the federal and the state and even the local levels.
Our thanks to Pedro Pizzato, President and CEO of Edison International.
Coming up on the program, a conversation with Jeff Gustavson, president of Chevron New Energies. He believes the future of energy is lower carbon.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies in 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go in the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele, and this is Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We continue with some of our best interviews from Bloomberg's NEF's annual Energy and Climate Summit in New York.
The summit brings together corporate executives, government officials, and industry leaders. This year's speakers at the event cover topics ranging from clean power, trade, federal U.S. policy, hydrogen, and climate technology.
We were joined by Jeff Gustavson, president of Chevron New Energies. Now, he believes the future of energy is lower carbon. He thinks that energy should be affordable, reliable, and ever cleaner. We first asked Jeff what Chevron's new energy unit actually does.
We launched these new businesses about 3 years ago. This is actually our third full year, and it's a suite of businesses that support our lower carbon strategy as a company. There's two pieces to that. One is lowering the carbon intensity of our traditional oil and gas business. The other part is growing new low carbon businesses and solutions to scale, and that's what Chevron New Energies is. We're focused on renewable fuels, carbon capture, utilization, and storage, hydrogen, carbon offsets, emerging technologies, and everything in between. This is something that's always been a passion of mine, the energy transition and low carbon energy. I love oil and gas. I grew up in oil and gas. But now shifting, seeing a company like Chevron with the capabilities we bring to this space, growing these new businesses, I couldn't be more excited about this role.
Jeff, what is, I don't know, if we fast forward 5 years from now, 10 years from now, how do you guys think about sustainable energy as a part of the overall portfolio of Chevron? What percentage do you think that might look like?
Yeah, good question. And when we launched, we announced that we were, you know, allocating or guiding to spending $10 billion over an eight-year period. Right? This would be 2021 to 2028. And that's just the starting point. So these are already a significant part of our capital allocation strategy. We have a very large oil and gas business, which requires a lot of capital to maintain and grow yep. that business to meet global demand. But these businesses are we're spending anywhere from $1.5 to $2 billion a year to support these new businesses. And my job and our job as a new segment is to find the right opportunities that are investable so we can grow this business even further.
You're based in Houston. Are guys like you, the new energy people, are you guys welcome in Houston?
Like the oil bar, the oilman's bar, that I would go to.
He's thinking like the cowboy
yes.
guys who stick like a pipe in the ground and get oil. He's thinking those people. Are you welcome in those bars?
Yes. and I love being referred to as a new energy person. I think there's three things that we really need to see in order to accelerate the growth of these businesses, and that's greater collaboration between private companies and policymakers, between governments around the world. It's lowering the cost of these new technologies and solutions, so customers, large businesses, or individual customers will buy them. And it is bringing capabilities to bear, the right capabilities. And that goes to your Houston question. The energy industry possesses a lot of the capabilities, technical, operating, commercial capabilities that are required to grow these businesses profitably to scale. So absolutely, a lot of this, a lot of activity in Houston, a lot of companies engaged in this. So Houston, it's an oil and gas capital. That's how it's thought of. It's also a new energy capital.
So where are we in terms of, I've been reading a lot on this. Alex, she knows that she's the expert. I've been reading up a lot on this over the last several days. It seems like the U.S. government's putting a lot of money into this. That's the good news, as Alex mentioned earlier. But I've also heard here over the last couple of days, it's still not easy doing business with the government. I'm thinking permitting for certain projects and things like that. What's been your experience there as to, is the government doing the best it can to kind of facilitate some of these investments and transition?
Yeah, so collaboration between the private sector and the public sector is fundamental here. It helps lower the cost. Those are, advocacy, understanding politics, not just in this country but around the world. Is a strength of our company, of energy companies, more broadly. So it fits one of our existing capabilities. But that is one of the starting points here. You need the right policy support, the right incentives to get the private sector investing even more heavily in this space. That will drive the technology forward, that will drive innovation, that will drive to building large-scale projects, which will lower the cost, make it more consumable for the world, and that is a cycle that will then continue. So it starts with policy, but it really is sustained by the investment by the private sector in technology. Government's a very important partner. We've seen we're having really constructive conversations with the government, but you mentioned permitting. There's still a long way to go to make all of this come together. We've shown some progress, but there are many steps in front of us.
Paul, though, to your point, it seems like the good part of this is that energy companies in the new energy world are in the room talking to people.
Yep.
Typically, the government and oil and gas have a contentious relationship at best in certain administrations, and it feels like in this area, maybe that is dissolving a bit, which would be helpful. Something that I've noticed, too, is that I think it was like $303 billion has been spent, I think it was last year, on all these new energy stuff. What I'm also hearing is that demand is a forgotten problem. Like, the money being spent on supplying the stuff and getting that cost down, but not enough is being spent on demand to incentivize a company signing up with you for ESAF, for something along those lines. Is that true?
There is a lot of money being spent in these new businesses. It's actually $1.7 trillion globally compared to about $1 trillion spent in the traditional energy business last year. And we need even more to grow these businesses to scale. And you hit on a very important point. It is, and I'll use hydrogen as an example. It's not hard to produce hydrogen. It's harder to produce low-carbon hydrogen at a low cost, something that we're working on using natural gas as a feedstock or using electricity and renewable power as feedstocks to produce low-carbon hydrogen. But transporting hydrogen to the market, you need policy support in order to do that. You need technological innovation to do that to lower the cost. And then importantly, encouraging consumers to buy hydrogen, making it easier for them to transition from a traditional product that they're using today to a lower carbon product that comes at a higher cost, that's where demand incentives and policy support will also be required.
Our special thanks to Jeff Gustafson, president of Chevron New Energies.
Staying at Bloomberg NEF's annual Energy and Climate Summit, let's have a look at Constellation Energy. It's an American energy company that provides electric power, natural gas, and energy management services.
It also operates the largest nuclear reactor fleet in the United States. So for more on the company, we were joined by its Executive Vice President and Chief Strategy Officer, Kathleen Barron. And we first asked her about some of the other things that the company is doing in the energy transition space.
Well, one of the opportunities we see ahead of our country is to find ways to decarbonize. It's really hard to find a way to run steel manufacturing, agriculture, aviation, long-haul shipping on electricity, right? So we have to find another way to decarbonize that sector and find a liquid or gaseous or a solid fuel that we're going to have at the ready at any moment to power those industries. And hydrogen has emerged as an opportunity for the U.S. now that the Inflation Reduction Act has passed. There's a production tax credit for hydrogen in that act. And we see nuclear and hydrogen as an ideal pairing because, as you pointed out, nuclear is clean, but it's also firm. It's reliable. It runs 24/7. And so it can be a steady source of power to run into an electrolyzer, split water into oxygen and hydrogen, and then create that clean molecule that can power industrial applications.
What color
with a clean
is that?
Fuel. Well, we're trying to discourage the rainbow of colors and just talk about clean versus emitting.
Copy.
But it is called pink for what it's worth.
Okay, just so we're clear.
Yep. So I was fascinated to know, I didn't know much about your company. Your company has the largest or the biggest nuclear fleet in the country with 21 reactors. What is the future of nuclear energy in this country as we, again, think about more green types of energy sources?
You know, it has changed a lot, even just in the last few years, in terms of public acceptance for the technology.
Totally.
It makes, I mean, not just our fleet, but the nuclear fleet generally generates 20% of the electricity that runs through this building we're in and in our economy every day. People don't really realize that, but it is the backbone of the power sector, and it is carbon-free and, as we just talked about, very reliable. It operates around the clock, no matter the weather, sun, wind, rainstorm. It's still operating. And we operate 21 reactors. We own 23, and so that's about a quarter of the U.S. fleet. And the beauty of these machines is that they can run for a very long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our assets are sort of in the 30, 40, 50-year-old time frame, but they can run up to 80 years, according to the federal safety regulators in Washington. And so they are constantly being rebuilt. We put in about $1.5 billion of new capital every year, and we're replacing the components. It's kind of like an old car that's having its parts replaced regularly. So these machines can run for a very long time. They abate about 500 million metric tons of carbon every year. So it's in the nation's interest to keep them running. And with this growing public acceptance, we're seeing interest in corporate procurements. We're seeing interest from governments. We're mm-hmm. seeing people valuing this thing that we don't have enough of, which is a clean, firm megawatt hour.
So when we talk about the hydrogen stuff, so pink, so basically you would get the power to split the hydrogen from the oxygen in the electrolyzer
more
using nuclear.
Chemistry.
Does that mean that if I'm building a hydrogen facility, I have to go where your power plant is, or are you going to be building a power plant, a small modular power plant near me, or are we running like a big tube of something in between me and you?
So what we're talking about is using the existing reactors to power an electrolyzer, as you said, split the oxygen and the hydrogen. You could do that right up next to the power plant, so you put the electricity right into the electrolyzer, or you could put your electrolyzer next to your manufacturing plant or whatever process you're trying to use the hydrogen for. Say you're making sustainable aviation fuel, and we can ship the electricity over the transmission line to your electrolyzer with a dedicated power purchase agreement. That's sort of hydrogen by wire configuration. So either co-located with the plant or through the transmission line, either way, you're going to have that steady source of zero carbon electricity going into the electrolyzer every hour.
Hmm.
Can I go out and build a nuclear power plant in this country today?
There is no reason why you can't.
But.
But. Thank you, Alex. There are a bunch of reactor technology developers who have new designs.
Yep.
You mentioned small modular reactors that are in the process of getting licensed. And there are some utilities who have created relationships with those technology developers for sort of co-development or, you know, an advanced commitment. But None of them are under construction just yet. Some of them are going to be starting soon. For example, in Canada, the Ontario Power Generator has partnered with the GE 300 megawatt reactor design, and they think they have been through regulatory approvals and they will start construction sooner. But in the U.S., we've lagged. I mean, this is happening in Canada, it's happening overseas, and we don't have that market pull here. We don't have commitments as much as we should to get those new reactor designs through licensing and into construction and past that first-of-a-kind cost cycle.
Our thanks to Kathleen Barron, Executive Vice President and Chief Strategy Officer at Constellation Energy.
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.